I'm going to be talking a little bit about some of the life cycle modeling work that I've been involved in since I started at NREL about 2.5, 3 years ago. Before I get started, I'd like to just touch on some of the topics that I'll be discussing today. First off, I'd like to go into the motivation behind this study. I mean, why in the world would DOE want to pay for yet another ethanol LCA, you know? So I also want to spend some time talking about the data collection and analyses that were used, because this is a modeling study. Understanding the sources of data and the analyses, as well as the assumptions that we used in this modeling, is crucial to really understanding the results and putting those into context. This table presents the results from 5 well-referenced studies that were published over the last 5 or 6 years for both greenhouse gas emissions and grams of CO2 equivalents per megajoule of ethanol, as well as net energy per liter of ethanol produced from corn grain compared to gasoline here. Instead of going into the details of each particular study, I just put this slide up there just to demonstrate the range of results that can be shown from a life cycle assessment of purportedly the same product, that is, ethanol from corn. You can take these life cycle assessment results and show that corn is actually quite a bit worse. Corn grain-based ethanol is quite a bit worse than gasoline. You can also show that it's quite a bit better on both greenhouse gas emissions and net energy value. I was talking to a colleague of mine about a month and a half ago who also works at NREL. They're involved in a large life cycle harmonization project. And I asked him just offhand, how many ethanol LCAs have been published in the literature right now? He estimated over 60. So you can imagine that the wide range of estimates for just greenhouse gases and net energy value across all those LCAs. DOE has recognized this, and DOE wants to be able to inform Congress, because Congress ultimately helps to fund research. DOE wants to be able to focus research in areas that matter. And with data spreads like this in the literature, how can you actually tell what potential pathway looks best and which one they should back? So about 2.5 years or so ago, DOE came to NREL and asked them to start to develop a life cycle modeling framework by which they can compare multiple fuels, multiple conversion technologies using the same sets of assumptions, and such that they can make more informed decisions and help to focus research. So why are some of these results so different? If you're doing a life cycle assessment of corn grain-based ethanol across 5 studies, across 60 studies, you'd think that they would be somewhat similar, right? Well, a study that was published about 5 years ago by Alexander Farrell and colleagues from University of California at Berkeley, they took several different LCAs of corn grain-based ethanol and did a meta-analysis. And they basically boiled it down to 3 points of differences between all of those studies, really account for most of the differences. These are very important concepts with regard to life cycle assessment modeling. That's, first off, the functional unit. What's actually the basis of the analysis? Is it a gallon of ethanol? Is it a hectare of land? Is it a unit of work done by that particular fuel, such as a kilometer driven? What are the modeling boundaries? What did the modelers assume, and where they draw their boundaries? Because you can't model the globe every time you build a life cycle model, you need to be able to be explicit and draw reasonable boundaries around the modeling system. And finally, and probably both the most nuanced aspect of life cycle assessment and probably one of the most significant aspects of life cycle assessment when it comes to affecting one's results, is how the environmental emissions and burdens are allocated among products. So, for example, did they split environmental burdens based on mass or unit energy? Did they use some type of product displacement? And it comes to most of those differences, once they harmonized all of those aspects, were actually very somewhat centered. So the LCA results I'll be presenting today have come out of this effort, and this is kind of a work in progress. We built up this model, and we published the results, or some of the results from this model, last summer in Environmental Science and Technology. We are building upon this, and we're using this modeling framework as kind of a living model, and we're constantly developing and expanding our capability. But the results I'll be presenting on today and focused on are based on 5 feedstock to ethanol pathways. We're looking at corn stover, wheat straw, and switchgrass converted using biochemical conversion. We also have forest residues that are converted using thermochemical conversion, and we have corn dry milling process using corn grain. This life cycle assessment, we include all of the life cycle stages from feedstock production all the way through end use. Because they want to be consistent, or because we wanted to be consistent with the Energy Independence and Security Act, we projected improvements all the way out to the end years, which is 2022. So we assumed advanced design cases, particularly for the conversion stage, and we also assumed some advances in the crop production stages, which I'll discuss in more detail. This is our first pass at this, so we're actually using a national average conditions. We're working currently on spatially disaggregating this model to a regional and even a county level assessment over the next year or two. So in this life cycle assessment, as I said, understanding the boundaries are really key to understanding the results. This life cycle assessment, we're looking at just the direct emissions and environmental burdens associated with producing ethanol from those feedstocks all the way through end use. We do include infrastructure, so we do attribute all of the environmental burdens associated with producing rubber, for example, that go onto the tires that are on the tractors that produce the feedstocks, the concrete and so on, associated with building the biorefineries. We take into account the avoided products as well as product displacement, so we try to account for all of those aspects across the supply chain. We do not account for indirect land use effects, and at this stage we're not accounting for soil carbon sequestration. We're actually working on two separate modeling projects that are going to address both of those, and we hope to have that in our LCA model by sometime towards the end of this fiscal year. So as I mentioned, since there are so many ethanol LCAs, there's over 60, how is this LCA any different? There are some of the unique aspects of this LCA is that we are comparing multiple feedstocks and multiple conversion technologies. NREL is located we actually have 2 pilot plants on site, so we're actually able to get conversion data directly from the pilot plant, so we can go from bench to pilot and get that data into our model. So we have process models that we've developed over years in Aspen based upon on those results from the pilot plant. So we have a close proximity to actual conversion data, so we're able to incorporate that. We also integrate with other DOE models. So for example, we work closely with the folks at Argonne National Lab and those people that run GREET there. We also work closely with Idaho National Lab on some of their feedstock logistics designs. In addition, we performed rigorous sensitivity and uncertainty analysis. As a few speakers ago shared the way in which they did their uncertainty analysis using crystal ball, we do we take a similar approach as well to produce a range or a probabilistic range of results. And also in the publication, as well as we're also working with the USLCI to make public all of our unit operations that we've developed in this life cycle assessment. So in the supplementary information in the journal article, we've published all of the input output tables of each process. This was on the order of 160 some odd pages worth of supplementary information. We're also going to make that available in the USLCI within the next probably 9 months or so in EcoSpold format, so you can download those. I really can't talk about the uniqueness of this without again acknowledging some of the shortcomings. Again, we are not including indirect land use effects, and we're not including soil carbon. We're working with University of Minnesota as well as Idaho National Lab and Oak Ridge National Lab to get those incorporated within the next year or so. As I mentioned, we have 5 feedstock to ethanol pathways. We've divided these up into crop-based feedstocks. The crop-based feedstocks for this LCA consist of corn grain, corn stover, and wheat straw. For all of these, we assume standard production practices. We use data from the USDA NASS and develop predictive equations and projections to the year 2022 for these. The residue removal rates for corn stover and wheat straw are based on a paper by Graham and colleagues from Oak Ridge National Lab. This removal rate is actually based upon soil moisture levels, and as I mentioned, once we develop a better handle on soil carbon, we're going to try to align that with soil carbon needs. We assume that switchgrass would be the dedicated energy crop in this particular analysis. We used the data from Ken Vogel's group from University of Nebraska to model switchgrass production. We used yields projected to the year 2022 again. The woody feedstocks we assumed would be comprised of forestry residues. We worked with the industry group Quorum to help develop the forestry residue models. These models are actually based upon 4 logging models that the Quorum has developed over the last probably 20 years or so. Quorum actually has nearly 2 decades of experience in life cycle assessment for forestry products, and so they were more than happy to team with us on trying to model some of these residues. As I mentioned, we work closely with Idaho National Lab on their feedstock logistics designs. In this LCA, we assume that the feedstock harvest and logistics would mirror the advanced feedstock logistics design from Idaho National Lab. This design essentially takes all feedstocks regardless of their source and densifies it and dries it such that it handles physically like a grain. They assume that there's going to be depots, so we have blending depots similar to some of the fuel blending facilities for petroleum fuels. The feedstocks will be blended such that the biorefineries can be feedstock agnostic. This has the advantage of reducing risk at the biorefinery as well as increasing the collection radius. We looked at 3 different conversion technologies. We used the USDA Aspen corn dry mill model with advancements to, again, we were trying to model a advanced case or a 2022 design case for the corn dry mill. So we worked with the USDA and tried to model those advancements. We also used NREL's biochemical process design, which is a dilute acid enzymatic hydrolysis conversion process, as well as NREL's thermochem process, which is indirect gasification mixed alcohol synthesis. Both of the NREL processes are nth plant designs, so they do take into account a mature industry. The ethanol distribution was assumed to occur without the help of pipelines. We assumed only rail, barge, and truck distribution for ethanol. We did attribute all of the additional infrastructure required to transport and to hold the ethanol. We did attribute that infrastructure to the LCA impacts of that ethanol, so the additional tankage and liners and so on for that. (Clears throat) The end use phase of this was modeled based on tailpipe emissions from GREET. The functional unit for this was 1 kilometer driven on a light duty vehicle. We assumed that 2022 CAFE standards would be 35 miles per gallon, which is consistent again with ESA. And onto the sensitivity and uncertainty analysis, we did the sensitivity and uncertainty in two stages. We used sensitivity analysis to try to isolate what, of all the parameters in the model, which parameters were the most influential on the overall results. And from this subset of parameters, we then used Monte Carlo uncertainty analysis to produce probabilistic results for the metrics that we're looking at. For the Monte Carlo analysis, we used a wide range of data from the literature. So for example, we looked at the ranges and distribution for nitrogen inputs, yields, and so on. In the absence of any hard data, we had to make some assumptions regarding the distribution. So for example, we assumed triangular distributions in the absence of data. The reference case, which is what we compare all of our results to, is actually based upon the mode of each input parameter as opposed to the mean. So it's a little bit different. You'll see some of the results from that. And we actually did not use a crystal ball. I saw that you used crystal ball in your study. We used a kind of a brute force method. So we went in between different software platforms. All right, this figure presents the results for greenhouse gas emissions. Let me take a second to set this up. On the x-axis on the top, we have the life cycle stage, again, from growing the feedstock all the way through vehicle in use. The y-axis, we have conversion technologies. Again, we have dry mill, biochem, thermochem, as well as the different feedstocks. Each number represents the cumulative GHG or CO2 emissions for that particular stage. These areas that are highlighted in green represent biogenic emission of CO2. So we have two fairly large emissions of biogenic CO2. Those are actually aren't counted towards the global warming potential. At the very end here, we have our reference case as well as our uncertainty analysis results. So we have the mean and median and the tails. Overall, from this, the overall results were actually kind of surprising to us, and that was that no matter what the feedstock and no matter the actual conversion technology, all of these options offer substantial benefits in terms of greenhouse gases relative to gasoline. We thought that there would be some clear winners between the feedstock to ethanol pathways, and we really found that when we look at the probabilistic assessment and look at the uncertainty, that all of these feedstock to ethanol pathways really overlap. And this was kind of surprising, but it's also encouraging in the sense that I guess corn ethanol is quite a bit better than we had initially given it credit for, or that it's where it has been published in the past, and that likewise we have a little bit more work to do in some of the cellulosic cases. Also significant is this the wide range of uncertainty around switchgrass. You'll see this in the next slide, which is water, but switchgrass has a high degree of uncertainty around it because it's not produced at a large scale. So there's uncertainty with regard to highly variable data as well as absence of data in some instances. We had to make some assumptions about the distributions, for example. When we look at the life cycle water consumption across feedstocks, again, these results aren't particularly surprising. This is liters of water consumed across the entire supply chain. Again, we also include infrastructure per kilometer driven. The red bars indicate the reference cases, and these indicate our uncertainty analysis. The bulk of this water for both switchgrass and corn stover has to do with assumptions regarding irrigation. So when we assume corn is irrigated as it is today, that represents our reference case. Whereas if we assume increases in irrigation, obviously that's going to have a huge effect on the water consumption across the life cycle. Likewise for switchgrass. In our reference case, we assume that switchgrass would be produced without the need for irrigation. But in our uncertainty analysis, we had a scenario in which we looked at, well, what if switchgrass water needs were met by irrigation, or what if we needed to grow them on irrigated lands? What would that look like from a life cycle perspective? So in conclusion, out of all the parameters that we looked at, greenhouse gases and water consumption are actually controlled or primarily dominated by just a few input parameters, and those tend to be clustered in the feedstock production phase. Although we didn't include indirect land use effects or soil carbon sequestration, there remains a substantial amount of uncertainty with regard to the data, particularly for some of these pre-commercial systems such as switchgrass production and some of the pre-commercial conversion technologies. Our reference case actually ends up being towards the tail of the distribution, suggesting that the reference case is really a fairly unlikely case. And looking at the reference case, this really reflects a case in which all of those input parameters are optimized in concert. Again, that's somewhat unlikely. Also to reiterate, the most important process is when it comes to sustainability in terms of climate and as well as water are centered in the feedstock production phases.